Hello and welcome to On the Page, a podcast happily brought to you by the Writers Festival of Belgium. I'm Alia Papageorgiou. I'm the director of that same festival, a longtime journalist. I'm a Brussels resident, originally from Melbourne and trying to be an author, but we'll see how that goes. We are looking, though, to keep books right at the top of your agenda here in Brussels and across Belgium and wherever you're listening to us. Today we meet Dr. Leah Broad, an Oxford researcher on female composers in classical music, which I had the pleasure of speaking to. She's been researching what seems to be a real concerted effort to remove female classical music composers from the public discourse and public history. Her new book is called Quartet, and I was fascinated to find out how it's going.
Great so far. I mean, so the reason I wrote this book is because I am tired of walking into bookshops and seeing so many biographies of women authors, of women artists, and then you hit the music section and it's like only men wrote music. And that is just not true. And yes, historically there have been more male composers than female, but that doesn't mean that women weren't there. And there have been systemic reasons that they've been excluded from the conversation. And so that was why I really wanted to write this book. And so far, I've been super heartened by the way people have been responding to it. It seems that people are kind of interested to find out more. And so far, that's very exciting.
So is that, do you think it's because it wasn't, it was just not being able to see the book that you want to read? That it's, you write the book that, you know, you're looking for on the shelf. So it's not like this realization when you were researching music. It was just like, I really want to read this, but where is it?
Yeah, pretty much that. And it felt like, well, why hasn't this book been written yet? Because I think this, the music that I'm writing about is so incredibly exciting. And I think we need a space in thinking about writing about biography and writing about composers. We have, you know, we accord huge amounts of biographical space to male composers as standard. I think we need that space for women as well. That was why I really wanted to write this book, as opposed to writing, you know, like a broader history of 20th century music that happened to include women. I did think about writing that book as well. And actually, I think for me, biography as a genre had the right combination of being able to deal with like the small details of people's lives and also the kind of broader historical changes that I wanted to be able to talk about. So that was why it ended up in the format that it's ended up in.
So you said the music you want to write about, tell us a bit more about the music you want to write. What is that exactly?
So I mean, the four composers in the book are Ethel Smyth, Rebecca Clark, Dorothy Howell and Doreen Carwithen. And every single composer is in that book because I think their music is extraordinary. Extremely different composers, the four of them. But they wrote music that is arresting, that is exciting. And so I wanted to be able to kind of bring readers to this music if they don't know it already. And if they do know it already, to then find out more about the personalities who actually produced it.
What makes a piece of music exciting to you? Like, what is it? Does that mean they're all pretty, like, very vivid and there's lots of, you know, there's lots of movement and things? Or is it something that moves? Like, what does exciting mean?
Oh, it's always hard to describe the music in words, right? Because what music does is so effectively communicate where words don't. But so I think they're four very different composers. Ethel Smyth's music is vibrant, it's very energetic. This is music where you hear it and it makes you sit up and go, gosh, this is exciting stuff. Rebecca Clark is doing something a bit more, I think, ambiguous sometimes. Her music could be quite violent. Terrifying sometimes, actually. Her piano trio makes you sort of go, oh, crikey, I don't know quite what's going on in this person's head, but it's something really dramatic. Dorothy Howell is a quieter personality. Her music's quite gentle, and you know, there are moments in her violin sonata, the second movement, for example, that breaks my heart. That is one of the most tender and sad pieces of music I know. And then Doreen Carwithen, I mean, she was a film composer. Her music is incredibly vivid. It's pictorial. I really love the energy of her music. It sort of has this propulsion to it. It's very rhythmic. And that's what I find interesting in her work.
They're very evocative. Like, the emotions come pretty quickly when you're listening to them, for you at least.
Yeah.
And I guess historically, if they're that. Well, now they will be well known because you found them and you've given them this life that, like, was denied to them. We can kind of say if we're being dramatic as well, but it's so until I saw, like, I see your tweets, and that's how we started talking about this. Like, just even the concept of it, it's like until you actually see it in black and white. I mean, we've been going through this, you know, females and take down the patriarchy and all this whole conversation for the sudden, since how many years now? But when it's not until you see all the different sectors in black and white where you're like, geez, where are the women? Where are the women composed? Like, where are the women artists? Where are the women X, Y, and Z? It's a constant, it's almost like you have to go through every single profession in a way to, like, get to the actual crux of the thing.
And especially because, like, with this book in particular, every single one of the women in the book was famous in their own lifetimes. I'm not digging out some person who, you know, nobody's ever heard of them. They happen to be writing quietly on their own. Nah, there's been a process by which these women have been forgotten. Because Ethel Smyth, for example, she was one of the most famous women in England at the time of her death. She was a dame. She was an honorary doctorate three times over. She was regularly invited to contribute to the BBC. She was a famous figure from the suffragette movement. There you have to ask, why has she been forgotten? Why is she not as famous now as Benjamin Britten? You know, his name is kind of synonymous with British music of the 20th century. I think Ethel Smyth should be up there as well. And I think what's really exciting now is that we are starting to see her music being recorded, it's being performed more broadly, and it's going to allow people to make up their own minds about this woman. And I think that's what we really need, is to have this music broadly performed so people can become familiar with it. How can you know whether you like a piece of music, whether you like a composer's works, if you never get the opportunity to hear them? And so that's what I'm really hoping for this book, is that it sort of, like, helps encourage people to come to their music.
Was it fairly straightforward for you to be able to talk about, like, did you find that it was difficult to get the publisher on board, or was that something that was kind of an easy exercise? It wasn't that they, or did you have to, like, look around and find the most appropriate source? Because what was your process like of getting these names to be published? Was it long and arduous, or
I guess, so this is kind of why I say that so far I've been so encouraged by people's responses to the book, because, you know, I put together the book proposal with my very wonderful agent, and when he sent it out to publishers, quite a lot of them were interested, and that was fantastic to get the response back that, like, there is this gap that we should be filling, and it's the gap that is telling stories about women musicians, particularly historically. And so that was really encouraging. And so, yeah, I'm obviously delighted that Faber have published the book.
Yeah, of course. So tell us a bit about writing the book. How was that? How was the whole, how long did it take to, it's in, like, when did the idea grew up in a moment of not being able to find this book, and then how long did it take before you were like, well, I have to write about it?
So one thing I want to say very quickly, but where we were talking about, you know, publishers being interested in the book, I think I have to sort of, yes, I've been doing groundwork on the research, but also other incredible women have been doing a lot of work before I have to get to the point where I can take this book to a publisher like Faber and them to go, yes, actually, this is a book we want to read. And, you know, there have been so many feminist musicologists and feminist performers as well who have recorded this music, who've made it available or available enough that I can then write this book and have people interested in it more broadly. So I think it's part of, like, a broader kind of ecosystem of feminism, if you like. That's how I think about it anyway. And then in terms of writing it, I mean, so I think it's taken about 3 years to get from proposal to publication. But it's building on research that's been going on before that. And so I've been working on kind of music and gender. And I think that it took me a while to decide who my four composers were going to be. And then I think it's mostly I write in a kind of strange way, which I don't know if this is strange. You can enlighten me. Is this strange? I don't know. But I tend to do as much research as I possibly can and then almost write the book in my head and then just put it down really quickly on the paper. And so the actual writing part takes me way less time than the research part.
That's so great.
But I don't know how usual that is for a nonfiction book. I don't know. Maybe everybody does.
No, I'm not sure. I have heard it once before, but most people like struggle with the day to day. But they mostly it's type of like fiction writers who are trying to build up characters and narratives. And yeah, for nonfiction, I have heard that before. It's like there was all these years of research or work on the topic, and then all of a sudden someone says to them, "Well, why don't you write about it?" And it's like, oh, okay, but. Okay, so that's pretty great. So you can kind of, it all came out like it was kind of already formed, like well, a piece.
I think it's because I have a chronic like hatred of editing my own work. I find it almost impossible to see something on the page that I've written, and then, I mean, obviously once my editor sends me comments and things like that, but I prefer to sort of work. Edit in my head before it's on the paper, because once it's on the paper it feels like I've committed to something. I'd rather sort of do it mentally and then try and get it as close as something I want it. And obviously, you know, sometimes my editor will send it back and go like, this needs rewriting, Leah. I don't like this bit. And then you just do it.
The cover's beautiful.
Yeah.
Could you see it like what you were could you see it beforehand, or that was just something
I had
they came up with and you're happy and it's everything.
I sort of came to this completely like you guys are the experts. You have sold way more books than I have. You tell me what should be on the cover and I will be happy with it. I just said, please don't give me photographs of the women in a kind of sepia tone that would look really, I don't know. I kind of wanted it to look a bit vibrant and have something that makes you go, huh, what's that? And so I am so happy with the final cover. I think it really says something. I recognize what I'm trying to do with the book on that cover. And so I'm really grateful that that's the final cover.
So when did you start this love affair with music? Did you music lessons or singing or just general? I'm assuming it's been forever, like since you were little, or am I wrong?
No, it has been since I was little. And honestly, I put it all down to I was really afraid of storms when I was like a really tiny kid. And my parents had this vinyl of Pavarotti doing highlights from La Boheme. And whenever there was a storm, they'd put this on because it calmed me down. And I just loved listening to these opera highlights for some reason. I really could only be like 3 or 4 or something weird. So it's always been a kind of comforting thing for me, I guess. And then I decided I really desperately wanted to learn the piano for reasons that are completely opaque to me. But this is what I decided I wanted to do. And so my parents very obligingly said, okay, well, we'll try and get you some lessons. And so originally I was actually wanting to be a concert pianist, and I really studied hard for that. And then
how many years was that?
I mean, I kind of wanted to do that up until I was about 18, 19, and then I did a lot of performing in my gap year and I was like, oh, I don't know whether this lifestyle is going to be right for me. And then I was applying for universities and I did my interview at Oxford and just something clicked and I was like, oh my God, this is so exciting. If I can have those conversations that I've just been having every day, that's amazing. That's incredible. That's what's been missing. And luckily I got into study there. And so then the rest, I've never really looked back. I've just loved doing the historical stuff so much.
did it already feel like a massive commitment that was going to lead to a lot of competition, or was it just the you know, that split second of between, well, playing it or actually going into the conversations?
Yeah,
or,
no, because
like, I didn't feel any of the competition of, you know, what would happen if you had to keep going.
No,
really.
No, okay, right. I don't think I thought about it that far forward, right? I was just like, oh, wow, this is something I want to explore. And I kept performing an awful lot right the way through university. And it's only much more recently, as really the kind of historical part has been my career, as opposed to, you know, like studying it at university. You're still exploring
you still
when you're
up
at
performing
university.
During in university. It's not like you stopped
tons.
The piano. Okay.
No, right. No,
oh,
not at all.
Yeah.
So, but I would say I don't play in a professional capacity anymore. I enjoy playing at home to my dog, who howls along, and he's very enthusiastic, but not professionally.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. What do you think about this idea of, like, classical music being, like, for a very small consumption instead of being a more public good or appreciated in a larger way, or...
Yeah.
No, apart from film scores, I mean, how far do we go with pushing it?
So, I mean, for me, like, I view it as that film scores are contemporary classical music, and we very regularly listen to classical music, and indeed it's some of the most widely consumed contemporary composition that we have. And so I think, you know, there are different forms and styles of classical music. I mean, let's deal first with how it is today. And, you know, classical music has a lot of press around it being kind of elitist, about it being for, you know, a kind of exclusive art form. And I think we only have to look at the popularity of classical music in film, in film scores, to go, okay, well, this is to do with perception rather than to do with necessarily the music that we're actually listening to. Because there's an awful lot of film music that sounds like music that was written in the 19th century. So it's more a perception around genre. Okay. And actually, so for me, I'm kind of like, well, if we can open up opportunities for people to hear classical music and decide for themselves what they think of it, that feels more useful to me than, I think, pre-deciding based on a genre whether or not you're going to enjoy it. Obviously, there are other issues here to do with kind of like the spaces in which we listen to classical music. And a lot of them we have to draw in like historical ideas about classical music. I mean, so again, it sort of depends what we're talking about when we talk about classical music. Are we talking about notated music? I assume so. And yes, there's been a kind of long trajectory over a period of many centuries of music being associated with the church and with the courts, then moving to a system of sort of like upper class patronage, then moving to kind of being more available to the middle classes. And certainly the period that I'm writing about, classical music is sort of broadly available to a middle class audience. The piano is, for example, becoming a very popular instrument amongst the middle classes. And so domestic music making that involves what we now think of as classical music becomes really very widespread in Britain in the 19th century. So, yeah, it is a sort of a very long process of music, well, classical music, notated classical music being made very widely available. And almost we're now seeing the kind of opposite direction of it being seen again as something that's maybe quite elitist. But as I say, these aren't sort of intrinsic to the music. This is to do with sort of broader social and cultural issues. I'm really heartened by the fact that whenever I go and speak about this music and people hear it for the first time, sometimes they know it already, sometimes they're hearing it for the first time, and the people who are hearing it new go, oh my God, this is great. Why haven't I heard this before? And that's exactly the question I hope they're going to ask, because then that's exactly the question that prompted me to write this book in the first place, is when you hear this music, you go, oh my God, it's so good. Why don't I know anything about the person who wrote this? So you know, and people don't have to like it. That's fine. If you hear this music and you go, sure, I am so on the fence about this, then that's okay. But at least you've heard it and had the option to make your mind up about it. So I think if we only ever hear Beethoven, Bach and Brahms, we don't have the option to go, do I like Ethel Smyth? I don't know. But if you've at least heard it and decided whether you like it or not, that I think is kind of where I want to be.
I'm just thinking, because I was looking at some of the other things that you've been doing, like to get out this word and to like to be able to bring these women closer to the public, including a documentary. I believe I saw last year that came out last year. How was that process and how did that come about?
So this was a couple of features that I did for Radio 3. And that was really good fun to make. You know, I love being able to do, you know, exploring these ideas in different mediums and in different contexts. And so that was really great because we were able to go and interview people who knew the women who we were focusing on.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously some of them I knew because I'd been interviewing them for my book. but we were also incorporating, you know, a broad range of women composers. And I think that it's really great that so those features were for Radio 3. And they've been doing some absolutely stellar work in terms of making music by women more broadly accessible. I listen to Essential Classics in the morning and I don't remember the last time where I turned on Radio 3 in the morning slot and did not hear at least one piece by a woman. And that is just not something that would have happened, I think, even sort of 10, 15 years ago. It's really been accelerated quite quickly. So, yeah, hats off to Radio 3 on that front.
I was just going to say, can you see the difference? But obviously you've seen it and it's been a big difference. So that's amazing.
I can in some places.
Some difference. Yeah.
And that, you know, we're still at the point where less than 8% of pieces performed worldwide by orchestras are written by women. Less than 8%. Wow. Right. In the year of our good Lord 2023, right? Like, that's quite an extraordinary statistic. And I just find it astonishing, honestly, that we can have that kind of wild gender imbalance. When we know, you know, like, it's not like feminism hasn't been happening for an awfully long time. And this is why I say, like, actually, at this stage, if you are not performing works by women, that's a choice.
Yeah. Less than 8%.
That's research that's done by DONE Women in Music, which is a really great organisation, and they survey worldwide orchestras every year, and so this is their latest round of research. And what's even worse is that's an improvement on the year before. So, like, you know, we're going in the right direction, I guess, slowly but surely.
What did you imagine would happen, like, the first day when you put things down and you said, okay, now this is gonna magically turn into a book? Did you think that it would do, that it would end up like how things are happening now, or was it?
No, honestly, you know, when I started putting this book together, I kind of thought, well, I'd love to write this book. I expect it to be so niche that nobody will be remotely interested in this book. And my wonderful agent was like, Leah, we are sending this book proposal out, and because I see something in it that maybe you don't. And I can't. Yeah, I'm just thrilled, honestly, to be able to have the opportunity to write this book and to share these women's lives, because I feel really connected to them after so long of sort of living with their diaries and their letters and really getting to know them as people. I really hope that people who read the book feel like they know these women by the end of it. And if I've done that, I will be so happy.
It sounds like that's like a big part of what you're trying to get out as well. But on the research, I did want to ask you about the research. Do you think it would have been like super difficult if you weren't in a university environment already?
So purely you need
that kind of archive data, was it not that easy even then?
So for two reasons, the first of which is purely practical and it's financial, right? So at the minute, my job is to do research, and so I can afford to go and do you know, like research trips. And so I've just spent a lot of my time for writing this book has been driving around the country, going to people's houses, sitting in their attics and like rifling through manuscripts. And that takes a lot of time. And so I'm really, really lucky to have been in the job that I'm currently in. And, you know, then also having access to university libraries. Wow, that is an incredible resource. The pandemic, not going to lie, was a big old spanner in the works, because I was like, wow, okay, I'm writing a book that means that I need to go and sit in people's houses and interview them for loads of time and be able to be in other people's homes. Obviously, that didn't happen. So I had to write the book all out of order according to what research I'd already done and what research I could do once lockdown ended. So that was kind of a challenge. And I really hope I don't have a pandemic in the middle of my next book, because I'm like, no, I am never writing a book out of order again. That was a nightmare. So that was an interesting experience.
So you already know that there's a next book.
Maybe I'm working day. I'm working on the next one now.
Oh, you already are. Okay, great. Oh, that's so great. That's so good. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Is it, what do you think? Is it like are there ideas? I mean, is it linked? If I can ask. If not, don't worry, we don't have to talk about it. But is it like something that just comes up and you're like, no, I really, really need to spend all my time researching this, otherwise it's just the end of the world.
No, I think it's
how do they feel? Do they feel like they take up all of your being, or do they feel...
I mean, I think if you ask my husband, he would be like, Leah becomes obsessed with the topic. There was a point where he sat me down at dinner and I was talking about my work that I'd been doing in the day, and he's like, Leah, you're talking about these women in the present tense, you know, they've been dead for a very long time, you gotta step back. I think so the next book it will be, you know, I probably won't talk about the exact topic, but it will be to do with women in music.
I can leave it out.
Don't worry, it's fine. I'm happy to talk about it's definitely gonna be women and music related, because I think that like this is just such an important topic and there's so much to write about, right? There's so much to talk about. And so that's why I'm probably going to stick within this area for book two.
You've mentioned your agent a couple of times.
Yeah.
Is it, is that something, did you already have them before you started writing, or when you could see that there was a book coming, you just knew that like maybe in the UK, you kind of need an agent to get it somewhere? Well, how was that process? So, because there's so many people that come to office. For example, in Belgium, there is no real English language publishing. It's either Dutch, it's either Flemish, or in French, or people go to the UK or the US for that. And a lot of people that came last year were like, well, I'm really looking for a publisher and I don't know how the whole agent system works in the UK. So like one of the goals is to also bring publishers and agents to them, to Brussels.
Great, okay,
definitely, because there's a lot of writers groups and they all kind of pull together and they're getting bigger in Brussels as well. I mean, that's a side note, sorry to bother you with that, but you've mentioned that a couple of times. Was it easy to find the right person, and was it easy to know what to look for? Have you already been around authors perhaps that had told you about it? Or
I sort of didn't know what I was doing in terms of finding an agent, because I was coming from an academic background and I made a very deliberate choice that I wanted my book to be broadly available, widely accessible to a broad public. And that included the language that I was using, the publisher that I wanted to go with, and the price point as well. Like academic books, if I wrote this book with an academic press, the price would likely be quite prohibitive for an awful lot of people. And to me, it really matters that like this research is available. And so with that in mind, I was like, okay, I have no clue how to do trade publishing. I'm definitely going to need an agent if I'm going to be even remotely looking at this area. And, you know, I'd spoken to a few agents and I think I was in an odd position because it's really unusual like music agents, people who know both the literary world and the musical world, are quite unusual, I think, because just not very many people write the kind of book that
I'm working on. Did that make it easier? So was there one that is music and literature?
Well, so this is why when I met the agent who I'm with, he has, he knows an awful lot about music, and we got on like a house on fire. And so I was like, oh, wow. Okay. If this Go Home would represent me, I would be so lucky. And thankfully he really liked the book idea. And he, I think if I remember right, he contacted me because he'd like seen my writing and sort of like my stuff in other mediums and wanted to talk about, you know, was I writing a book? And I was like, well, now you mention it, yes, I'd love to write a book. And so we sort of talked about different book ideas, and this is the one that I think both of us were passionate about. And so he's been amazing.
Thank you so much for taking
thank
this
you
on.
Thank and you very much for inviting me. Thank
good
you.
Luck with everything, and looking forward to the launch. How many have you got, like 1,000 events to go before and things to do before it comes out, or is it all taken care of? You don't have to.
I've got a few.
That was Dr. Leah Broad talking to us from Oxford in the UK on her new book Quartet, which came out on the 1st of March, published by Faber, and so needed in this time. We'll be back with more interviews, ideas, and episodes soon. Keep writing, if you're writing, and join us for the Writers' Festival of Belgium on the 13th and 14th of October. You'll find all the details at Writers' Festival of Belgium on Twitter and Facebook. We are working on a web page. We will let you know when that's complete. I'm Alia Papageorgiou, and this podcast was made possible by our producer, Paul McNally, at podcast.brussels. Talk to you soon.